Hi, welcome to the show. I'm John Stabler, and I'll be your host. And with me today is my co-host, Stephen Brett.
Howdy.
How's it going, Steve?
I'm all right, thanks, John. You okay?
Yeah, good. Been up too much this week?
Not a great deal. Just the same old work, home, sleep, eat.
Fair enough. I know you've been too busy today to read up much, but I found so much stuff that I think we're going to have a field day.
Fantastic.
So, we'll start off with this. BBC News, one of my favourite websites because it's one of the few that isn't completely biased.
I do love the BBC myself, I have to be honest. It is my source of news for the day.
Great. So, what, you check it first thing in the morning throughout the day?
Throughout the day, to be honest, yeah.
Cool.
I probably get paid to actually check a BBC website rather than to actually do any work, to be honest.
Right, that's great. So from now on, we're not going to reveal who it is that you work for. So that's going to limit quite a few things in the future. But I'm sure that's not true anyway. Okay.
No, it really is.
Okay. Right. I saw this story. Now, this is something that appeals to me because I'm a bit of a science geek. And it starts off a bit boring, but I think you might appreciate some of the spin that gets put into this. The title is EU Health Food Claims Law Begins to Bite. Okay.
Oh, I think I hear about this actually.
So we've got a lot of health foods these days.
Mm-hmm.
And just off the top of my head, you know, like stuff like Yakult, which is yogurt, and Activa.
Your probiotics.
Yeah, and this is what this story is about. In particular, as well as some other dietary stuff.
So well, things like glucosamine as well?
That's not mentioned, but what is that?
Glucosamine is a herbal remedy. I think it's found naturally in the body, but it's supposed to promote ligament health. But I think some of the claims have come out recently doubting the truth of those stories. And I think it might fall under this health food bracket, possibly.
Great. So they're saying health foods would be nothing without the claims that they make on the packaging. I mean, we see these adverts all the time. It's like, yeah, check this out. This is good for you. Sometimes they don't even tell you why it's good for you.
Sure.
They just use the word healthy a lot.
I mean, to be honest with you, it tends to be if they tell me it's healthy, I tend to avoid them.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are like that, but I don't think it's due to any sort of inherent scepticism.
No, it's just because I like pies.
Well, don't we all? Some of these claims soon might vanish, though, because there's been some European regulation.
Of course, good old EU.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people are really happy about more of that, which demands that health food companies, they need to come up with scientific evidence to back up their labelling. So I think already we can see that this might cause some trouble for the manufacturers. And the regulation extends to a vast range of products from multivitamins and slimming pills to margarine and yogurt. So it's not just necessarily things that say they're healthy just for the sake of eating them, like these yogurts, but margarines that might make some claims.
I think something else which is being included in this as well is your sugar-free chewing gum with the claims that they reduce plaque. I think that's been proven to be completely unfounded.
Should I tell you what, that is amazing, because I read that, it was a story related to this, but that is indeed one of them. It's not mentioned in this particular copy I've got here, but that is one of them. And it's quite strange, actually, because when I first heard about the chewing gum and the chewing it makes, it's meant to encourage the production of more salivary amylase, which is the saliva in your mouth, and the enzyme that's meant to break down sugars and stuff, carbohydrates into sugars. That is not pH neutral, and apparently it's meant to neutralise the acid.
Okay.
That was what it was. And to be fair, I mean, that sounds pretty, you're like, yeah, that sounds about right, yeah, it makes sense.
Plausible.
It definitely passed the plausibility test. But by the sounds of it, from what I read, yes, you're absolutely right, that it's complete bunkum by the sounds of it. So, okay, so just coming back to this now, so we've got Nutrition and Health Claims Regulation now. It's apparently already been adopted, but as with a lot of regulation, it takes ages to come into force. And so they're trying to say, right, we want to stop unsubstantiated, exaggerated, or untruthful claims about foodstuffs. Which, sounds like a noble effort.
That sounds perfectly reasonable to me.
Yeah. So, among these claims, and this is quite interesting, is the suggestion that green tea is good for blood pressure, cholesterol levels, bones, and teeth. So they're not just going necessarily after multinationals. They are, green tea is just meant to be a natural product.
Sure thing.
But they're saying, right, anything, you know, unless proven scientifically, we're going after it.
Well, I'm rather partial to cut green tea myself.
I do like the taste of it.
Especially after a little visit to the old Chinese, to be honest with you.
Right, also reeling from this is the lucrative probiotic drinks and yogurts industry, which you mentioned. A lot of links to a host of probiotic strains have been rejected. So they've come out, they said, hey, this stuff is good for you in some way. And now all of a sudden they're saying, you've got to prove it. Yeah, sorry. You can see.
I was just going to say, you know, it's difficult for those companies, I think, now, and difficult for the consumer as well. We've had so long of having these health benefits, so-called, thrust down our throat for such a long time, that it's going to be interesting to see how the ad campaigns are going to change and differ to actually start telling the truth around these stories. You know, buy your cult, it doesn't do anything for you.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of leaves them dead in the water, really, and I think that's why they're, you know, pretty angry about it. I got a quote here from Ioannis Misopoulos, sorry if I pronounced that wrong, Director General of the International Probiotics Association. So they've invented an association already to look out for their interests.
Yeah, I mean, no vested interest there at all.
No, it just screams lobby group, doesn't it? It can take 3 years to get these kinds of human studies together, but in the meantime, the claims are going to be wiped away. The regulation is killing this industry, and the job losses are already being felt. So, straight away, he's in there with, you know, some kind of, like, emotional blackmail. You know, people are going to lose their jobs. You're wiping away our industry. But
it's an industry based on lies. Allegedly.
Allegedly, there's no evidence in it, so it is, yeah. I don't think he appreciates our purity on the subject.
I mean, you know, I'm quite happy, you know, if the evidence comes out and proves that these probiotics are of benefit and, you know, do promote healthy bacteria in the gut, which is going to improve my immune system. Great, fantastic. Prove it to me. I'll take that on board. In the meantime, to base your whole business on claims which could quite possibly be bunkum, is, well, fraudulent, really.
Yeah, I mean, you deserve everything you get, really. But, you know, I mean, they're saying, I just can't believe they're trying to defend their position along the lines of, you know, well, you haven't it's almost saying you haven't disproved it, you know, I mean.
It's like the snake oil salesman, you know, back in the days in the West, you know, it's, they are no better. Yeah. Allegedly.
I like this. I mean, this is the first podcast we're doing, and already we're worrying about litigation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I have to go back and say, you know, I mentioned your cult earlier. That was just purely the first name which sprung into my head. I have no vendetta against your cult.
Yeah.
Or any particular individual business at all.
I was just naming the ones that came, as I said, to the top of my head, like, you know, something that I'd seen on the telly recently, I'm sure. You know, very good adverts, though.
Absolutely, well, clearly the address works. You remember the brand name.
Well, not just that, but you've just done this spiel about how, you know, this what is it? It does something in your stomach.
Promotes the growth of healthy bacteria in your gut.
I'm not going to go on too long, because there's a lot of stuff on this. I mean, but the one thing that's going to get hit is SlimFast, okay?
Oh, interesting.
Now, I mean, people have been using SlimFast for a while. But the fact is, it's not necessarily that they're making ads with ludicrous claims or something like that. The very name itself, apparently, makes a claim about the product. It's slim and fast.
Mm.
And I think they got a problem with saying that, you know, this product is trying to give you, it's giving you like a time scale. So you're going to lose weight in a short time scale, and then they have a problem with that. Because obviously, people diet in different ways. Some people can get away
with it. Well, that's fair enough. And, you know, rapid weight loss is dangerous, kids.
It's not a public service announcement. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Right. Now, I had that story because, as I said, it's a bit geeky and it might not be to everyone's taste. But I liked it because it would segue into something that's happened today. Okay.
No, I like it.
Yesterday. I don't know. I know you follow some people on Twitter, but I don't know if you follow everyone I follow. Have you heard of Ben Goldacre?
Can't say that I have.
No. He writes a column for The Guardian. He's a scientist, a bit of a skeptic. He's always looking out to bust nonsense, you know, bad science. You know, he's the kind of people that brings other journalists to task about inaccurate reporting, things like that. So he's a real geek, in a good way, of course. Gillian McKeith. Now, do you know who that is?
That name rings a bell. No, she's not new Prime Minister of Australia, is she?
No.
That's Gillian something, isn't it?
I don't know, but... Yeah. No, I've got no idea. Well, I thought you might have heard her. She's on daytime TV.
The name does ring a bell. I don't profess to watching a lot of daytime TV, John, being a fully employed person.
Of course. Not that being unemployed is anything... No, I'm going to stop this right now, okay? I mean, this is like an opinion piece, so...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, right, so...
Go ahead and get a job.
All right, Gillian McKeith, again, right? We're talking about snake oil. We were talking about bogus health products and things like that. She is a millionaire-ess health food nutritionist... Advice, medicine.
Definitely not the Prime Minister of Australia.
Definitely not, no. So you were wrong on that one. What happened is she's got a PhD, you know, so she goes around calling herself doctor.
Right.
But some of the stuff she was coming out with was very suspect. And of course, people thought it was a bit strange. A learned person would be spouting such nonsense.
Who's paying her?
Sorry?
Who's paying her?
Herself. She's just made so much money... you know,
she doesn't have a specific agenda then?
Well, yeah, she does, making money for herself.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't have to be in the pocket of health food industry because she sells her own health food products.
Right, okay.
So, and she puts her name on it. And she's a household name, apparently. I mean, I don't watch, same as you, I don't watch much daytime TV. But anyway, she came out with some really weird stuff. And just off the top of my head, one of them, which I found funny, was you should eat lots of green plants, okay, and green foods. Now that, I agree with. Anybody who says, eat more green food, green beans, you know, healthy stuff, I'm all for that. However, some of the stuff she came up with is a bit bunkum. She was saying it contains chlorophyll, which maybe...
It does.
But the chlorophyll, okay... It oxygenates your body. So,
okay.
Yeah, so now we're starting to go into the kind of like pseudo...
pseudoscience, yeah.
Because you've got the chlorophyll in your stomach, say. Now it's just probably going to get broken down like any other stuff. But
and I thought chlorophyll relied upon light to activate it anyway.
You read my mind, okay? So, unless you're... So, this isn't my gag that I saw this online. Unless you're willing to stick a torch up your butt. It's not going to work, is it? Okay, so, and you don't want oxygen in your stomach anyway, because you're going to be producing some methane. Nice explosive combination there. So it's just kind of random stuff like that. And she's just basically looking for a way to justify selling healthy products, you know? But not anyone can just go and buy broccoli, you know? You don't need to pay over the odds for it. So, you know, they're always looking for ways to...
I'm certain that broccoli contains quite a lot of chlorophyll naturally, anyway.
Yeah. But, you know, they can't sell that, can they? They can't make a profit on it when the supermarkets are selling it for...
Absolutely not.
Okay, so, the PhD they found out, because, you know, the alarm bells ringing, it's from a diploma mill in the United States of America.
Fantastic.
Okay, so now I'm going to read from this. This is just updated this afternoon. I've been watching it live, unfold on Twitter, but here it is, okay? There was a random person, her name here is Rachel Moody. She's not famous, she's not some kind of celebrity or anything. She's just your average Joe. I think she's got about 50 followers on Twitter. And she posted something on Twitter saying, can't sleep, so excited about the next chapter of Bad Science. She's reading Ben Goldacre's book.
Okay.
It's an excellent book, if you get time to read it. You'll be surprised by some of the rubbish science that's reported, and the book just reveals it all. So she's talking about the next chapter. It's the one on Gillian McKeith, and then in brackets, not PhD. Okay, so it was alluding to that. Now, apparently Gillian McKeith, multi-millionaire-ess, you know, she's quite famous in her own right.
And I'm sure she's got a lot of lawyers as well.
She has. She's already, you know, threatened to sue several people for libel, supposed libel. But when you say something about someone it's true, that's not really libel, is it? Not in my book, anyway. So, this Gillian McKeith, obviously what she loves to do is Google her own name during the day. Because she shows up on this girl's Twitter and decides to have a go at her, okay, about her talk about not actually having a real PhD. And the prelude to this as well was But Keith was told by the ASA, the Advertising Standards Authority, okay, she can't put doctor on her products anymore because it's misleading. It makes people think that she's a real doctor and that, you know, she's endorsing it as a doctor. So they told her that she had to stop that. So everybody knows it's bunkum. Starting off, 556. Is it that you don't like my doctorate PhD because it's from America and you're discriminatory? Sorry, and you're discriminatory. USA knows how to educate too. So she's on the defensive. But she follows up with, sad thing, Rachel, that your excitement comes from negativity. Think about it. And then she comes back in again with another tweet. Miss Anti-American, how sad a life to enjoy reading lies about another by an ass who makes money from pharmaceutical giants. So now she's actually saying that Ben Goldacre is a liar and he's in the pocket of pharmaceutical giants. And then, to finish it up, so you believe if you tell a lie enough times it becomes fact. It doesn't, honey. Your anti-American bigotry is too glaring. So now she's saying that this girl is racist.
Marvellous.
She doesn't think that she has a degree from a reputable source. So,
so what university was her degree from? Do we know that at all?
I don't know the name of it. However, what started this off yesterday was Ben Goldacre posted a tweet announcing that so-called institution has now been shut down.
Marvellous. Sounds reputable.
Obviously, it's not as reputable as some other places. You know, I'm sure America has some great universities. But wherever that was, obviously, they didn't get funding or something.
It wasn't Harvard, was it?
No. No, it definitely wasn't. No. I'm just trying to remember now, because I want to be fair, it's not. It wasn't Yale. No, it wasn't. No, never mind. Okay. Is there anything you want to talk about?
No, I'm cool at the moment, just going along with what we've got here.
Right, okay. Right, this one, we're going to start... Okay, right. We're going to do this one, because this is one of my favourite from the week. When I say favourite, I mean, you know, it made me angry more than some other stuff. French Parliament approves ban on face veils.
Oh, brilliant.
So, we're going for hard
hitting. Vive la France.
Vive la France, indeed. Do you want to say anything before I maybe just give a bit more facts? What's your take on this, from what you've heard?
Well, I don't really know what to say, to be honest. I mean, I would defend the right of anyone to wear what they wanted to wear, and I don't think a government should be passing legislation on what I can or cannot wear. The question comes down to the fact, though, is are these women wearing these veils out of choice, or are they being enforced to wear them by their husband or religious imams, whichever? I think that's what the debate focuses on, or should focus on. Now, you know, as a citizen of the UK, I have the right to wear whatever I want, whenever I want, wherever I want.
Within, obviously, you've got some kind of decency laws there.
Well, yeah, there has to be some sort of taste. I mean, my Hawaiian shirt probably should never be seen out in public again. But,
yeah, so, I mean, you've still got that restraining order on that shirt.
Still got that restraining order on that shirt. It's ASBO'd up. We shouldn't have our governments dictating to us what we can and can't wear in a free choice where you have freedom of speech and freedom of expression. But that's where this stumbles over, because as I've said, it's all down to why the women are wearing the veils. Hmm. Is it their choice? Is it being enforced upon them?
So, yeah, and the thing that hits me is this legislation. I mean, they've approved it. There's another, it's like a, it's, you know, the Commons approve it, and then there's some other, like...
Senate, I think.
Yeah, something like that. They've got to look at it and give it and rubber stamp it, basically. However, there are fears that this is unconstitutional, so it's nice that France have a constitution like that that protects freedoms. Absolutely. Something I wish that we should have, but that's just my opinion.
Well, I like the British unwritten constitution.
The unwritten, yeah. You have loads of rights until, whoops, they've gone. that's my kind of... No, that's not my kind of constitution. So it's approved this ban. Now, the move is popular among French voters.
Which does surprise me somewhat, because, you know, France is renowned as being a left-wing country. And that seems to me to be a relatively right-wing sentiment.
Is it fear, you know? Is it like in this country where you get like a right-wing interest group or press who whip up fear of the Birka or something like that.
Absolutely, because what it suggests to me is that we're going down the line that, you know, if a woman is wearing a veil or she's wearing the full-on burqa, that she somehow is a religious extremist. Or, the other thing is that maybe there's a religious extremist hiding underneath the veil who may be male. Which has been some of the arguments that I've heard against the full veil burqa, which just seems to be quite ridiculous, to be honest with you. You know, if you go to a country like Pakistan or like Afghanistan or even, I suppose, Saudi Arabia in some places, okay, not glittering examples of human rights bastions of supporting people's rights there at all, but, you know, these women wear these veils around there and, you know, they're not necessarily terrorists. Are they forced? For me, I say the question just comes back to, are they forced to wear the veils or not?
Well, I agree, and I think it's a sign of misogyny at the end of the day. And
yeah, I mean, again, I kind of part agree and part disagree with you there, because I think to suggest it is purely down to misogyny is to take away the thought that these women might have any say in it themselves. Admittedly, maybe they don't.
Sorry, just to clarify, what I meant to say was its roots are in misogyny, okay? The idea of women enforced to cover up. I mean, they explain it as, okay, men shouldn't...
Well, it's about, you know, men being weak and giving in to temptation and, you know, seeing a woman's flesh, you know, being tempted by the woman. It's the same with Victorians wearing skirts to cover their ankles because it might drive a man wild.
Right. But what they haven't realised after all these thousands of years or whatever is that maybe it's the men who need to do something about it and not the women.
Sure, absolutely. But, you know... It's a religious thing as well, because, you know, some of these women may feel that by dressing in such a way, they are honouring their God. And what they're doing is absolutely right. And, you know, who are we to judge them on that? And their religious freedom, okay, maybe that we think that religious idea is outdated. And I wouldn't be inclined to disagree with what you said, John, at all. But, you know, these women feel that they're honouring their God, and why should we take that away from them?
Yeah, and for that reason, I don't believe they should be banned. If I knew, okay, that every single woman that wore a burqa was being forced to wear it, I would say, well, yeah, let's ban it. But that's not the case.
Absolutely.
There's a very large proportion of them that, as you said, they feel that they're doing the right thing. It's their faith. It's their belief. And so, I don't, and even if they weren't wearing it for religious reasons, what if they just wanted to wear it because they enjoyed it? You know, or they were shy?
Absolutely.
I think you shouldn't have to have a reason. There's no reason... apart from Western mistrust, you know.
Well, you know, the media's whipped up this storm, really, and it's across Europe. It's not just in the UK, it's in America as well. That, you know, if a woman is wearing a burqa, she's clearly a Muslim extremist. And the media gives credence and support to these claims almost daily.
Yeah, and it's pretty ridiculous, to be honest.
I mean, I shouldn't have thought it certainly isn't a matter for state to be passing legislation on.
Yeah. I mean, just quoting here from the article, the main body representing French Muslims says face-covering veils are not required by Islam. I'm afraid that that's just going to be a case of there's going to be people within Islam who disagree with that statement.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they say it's not suitable for France, so maybe their angle is that we're the French Muslims, and, you know, we want to integrate, and so, you know...
But then that should be something which comes from... I mean, you know, in the UK, with, for instance, the Church of England, we've got the General Synod, or the governing body in the Church in Wales. I'm sure there's some sort of equivalent for the Muslims in France. Surely that's down to them, as a religious community, to pass a doctrine on the wearing of the burqa or the wearing of the veil, and not the position of the national government.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. There's one proviso, because I've looked into this, I've been following this for a while, this French, mm-hmm. before this story, I have been keeping an eye on it.
That has been rumbling on for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah. I look in terms of, you know, freedom, okay? As I said, I agree these women should be free to wear whatever they want. However, if there is a good reason for them not wearing it, for instance, for security reasons...
Sure, I mean, well, for instance, if I can't wear a motorcycle helmet into a bank or a post office.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. And so, therefore, for the same reason that they shouldn't. They'll have to remove it, or at least identify themselves. You know, like they do in airports currently. I believe they've got to. You know, when they have a passport checked in the UK, at least they have to reveal their face just to check the passport.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And they usually get to go. You know, it's an accommodation. They get taken aside. And it'll probably be a female that does it. But that's just simple accommodation. It's not a problem to accommodate such a belief, because that's where it's stemming from. Mm-hmm. So I'm fine with that. But if there's security measures that requires that you show your face, I think everybody has to do it.
Yeah, and I agree. But I think the example that you used is fair enough. I don't think there's an issue with that, to be honest with you.
I mean, I'm not going to ignore the fact that it's not practical, is it?
No, I mean, it's not. I mean, certainly by our Western sensibilities, it does seem to me to be more than a little bit extreme and unnecessary. You know, it is my understanding from what I've read about it that the Quran doesn't mention anything about a full veil or being fully covered. It mentions being dressed respectfully.
I think the word they use is modestly.
And modestly.
Yeah.
So, I think it is the key, really, and it does seem to be going a little bit far.
I don't think a full-on burqa is modest. I think that's going completely the other way, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely. It is extreme. But I don't think we have a reason to fear the burqa, I think. Which I think is part of the problem. You know, we seem to have this fear of it.
Okay.
So I think we've done burqas, haven't we, really? I think we're in agreement, really, that... Oh, I think we are. That it's not a matter for a state. It's a matter for a religious governing body to make that decision.
Well, no, I'm not even that. I think it's a woman's decision. I think it shouldn't be the religious, really, ultimately.
Well,
it's the individual.
Yeah, no, but I think that in this case it would be the province of the religious body to make that decision. But it's, you know, the woman's decision whether she wears it. The French Muslims, Society Association, whatever it was saying that they don't think it's suitable for France. Well, that's for them then to pass that judgment, not for the French government. I don't see that should be their issue at all.
Oh, the one thing I did want to say about it is this legislation, if they actually think it's going to help, right? Because one of the facts that I didn't mention was that the lefties, okay, the Socialist Party, didn't vote against it. They abstained from the vote.
Right, because, okay.
And they were pressurised to do that, apparently, allegedly, by women's rights campaigners. You know, who obviously do have legitimate concerns about women's rights here.
Absolutely.
You know, in respect to women that are being forced to wear them.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was the socialists' ideology that the women should be able to wear them if they want, then they should have voted. I can't understand.
Yeah, abstaining helps no one in that sort of circumstance.
It's just making a statement.
It's purely political statement and posturing.
But what this legislation will do is, the women who are forced to wear them, who are truly forced... It's simple. They just won't be allowed to leave the house anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the other problem for me is that, you know, it's going to show off the egos.
Brilliant. Yeah. But not. You might start seeing some more hot ones as well. You got to know. You get the rough and the smooth, don't you?
Oh, you know, I reckon if you'd be kept in the dark behind the veil for, you know, most of your life, I'm guessing you...
Might be a bit pasty, isn't it?
A bit pasty, yeah.
This is one for you, buddy. The Church of England today moves a step closer to ordaining women as bishops after the Archbishop of Canterbury warned against dropping the issue into the difficult basket and further delaying resolution. So this is an ongoing battle.
Yep.
Do you want to... I'll tell you what, you can elaborate on this.
No, well, I mean, the Church of England is slightly different to the Church in Wales, which I'm more familiar with. I believe... I don't know when you printed the article off, but I believe that the synod has now passed the motion to accept the ordination of women as bishops, I think.
Right. While you're going to check that, I'm pretty sure they have now, but it's that I want to talk about, actually. But I'll just continue from this while you read that, check that out. After almost two decades of infighting, posturing and politicking over the issue among traditionalists and liberals, a fragile peace has emerged, with both sides accepting that local arrangements should be made for Anglicans wanting to exempt themselves from female leadership. Now, when I look at it, that everybody is born equally, and everyone has equal rights, and so therefore discrimination goes against those rights.
Absolutely. I mean, I absolutely 100% agree with you. You know, for me, there's absolutely no reason why a woman could not perform the duties of a bishop. And I mean no reason in law, and no reason in scripture why
a
woman...
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it is, of course, the evangelicals, conservatives, who have been using scripture, because they look at it from the point of view that because Jesus didn't have any female disciples, and because the ones that went on to start the churches were all men, and they didn't appoint any women, therefore women shouldn't be leaders in the church. And then it was the same idea that was preventing them serving as priests in the first place as well.
Sure. And for me, that's the whole point, is that once you've accepted that women can be priests, which is absolutely quite right, there's absolutely no other reason why you could stop a woman being a bishop. Absolutely ridiculous. So I'm still trying to find the note. It looks to me, from what I'm reading at the moment, yes, it has been passed. Absolutely quite right. And I think it is, in some respects, a very sad day for the church, because it will lead to further division, which I think is very, very sad at a time when
inevitable.
I think we should be unified. It is inevitable, because unfortunately, you know, these few things are deeply ingrained in tradition. But for me, tradition is not the same as doctrine. And I think, you know, I'm speaking from the top of my head here rather than from real knowledge, so I may be incorrect, but I believe that it's 2 Timothy which tells us that women should not be or should not have any say over a man in church, and should dress with, you know, again, dress modestly, not, you know, paint their face or any such things as that. Is it Timothy?
It is 2 Timothy, verses 11 to 12. I'll just go through it. Let the woman learn in silence with all subjection, but I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to assert authority over the man, but to be in silence. I don't know what follows that.
No, for me, if I'm commenting, sorry, John. That was written by Paul.
Yes.
That was written practically 2,000 years ago. And whilst I believe fully and firmly that the Bible is a good guide for us to live by, I don't necessarily agree with the claims of evangelicals or traditionalists that, you know, the Bible is the unadulterated word of God. I think any poor theologian, such as myself, would be able to tell you and you know, show quite convincingly that the Bible has been influenced by men over the years. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And the thing which we have to consider is that Paul was writing to a particular church at a particular time. This isn't a general message for everyone. This is a particular message for that particular church at that particular time. And I think if we take it out of the context, which clearly has been done, that we now live by this as being some kind of doctrine, then we're making a big mistake.
Well, I mean, you can't get away from the fact that if you're going to follow down the path of inerrancy, we all know how stupid it's going to end up being. So,
absolutely. I mean, you know, again, you look at the Bible, you look at the Old Testament, and you look at the scriptures pertaining to dietary laws, for example. How many of these people who are against the ordination of women, be it as bishops, priests, deacons, whichever, eat bacon, just as an example?
You know, how many of them wear synthetic fabrics? Because
absolutely, and you know,
not to mix any,
eat mussels, prawns. You know, the Bible explicitly forbids these things. You know, when was the last time anyone went out and stoned a gay man?
Well,
because that's what the Bible tells us we should do if we know any gay men. Now, you know, I'm sure that would, and this may be a bit controversial, cut the clergy in the church by about half.
As it already has done with the goings on in Uganda.
Yeah.
I'd love to rant about that one day. There's another Another verse here against women. Corinthians. Do you know who wrote this?
I do believe that was Paul.
Again, yeah. I think there's a bit of a... It's things like this that have led a lot of people to accuse him of being a bit of a misogynist, I think.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough.
Yeah. So you agree that criticism is...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at the end of the day, what you have to remember is this, and I'm sorry to be tarring people with the brush here, but Paul's background was as an extremely Orthodox Jew. Understandable, therefore, that his thoughts are somewhat misogynist.
Yeah, so Corinthians 14, here you go, let your women keep in silence, more silence again for women, poor women. Yeah,
well, sometimes that'd be quite good, I'm sure you'd agree.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's really going against their natural tendencies. Ooh. Sorry.
Let's not get too controversial tonight, John.
Let's keep it down to burkas and scenario. In the church's spirit, it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for a woman to speak in the church.
The church over the time was very much adopting the Roman method of assimilating parts of religion into their own religion. And one of the things which the Church of Corinth had done, I believe, was they'd assimilated cultic prostitution into their worship, their religion. And Paul, I believe, was writing against that. There was no place for it in his view of Christianity. And, you know, I think that's fair enough, because I think that would detract from the message which is, you know, given to us by Christ, which I follow myself, and I believe that to be love your neighbour and love God. And those are the two things which I think were the two commandments Jesus has given us.
Now, the church, if it's just like some old boys' club, you know, private club or something, you know, obviously, they get to do whatever they want. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, the church is it's a bit more than that. I mean, it's the established church.
In England, not in Wales.
In England, yes, yeah. Now, as an organisation that is funded by the taxpayer, do you think that they should be entitled to discriminate something which is illegal in our countries? You know, you can't just discriminate against people. It's the law. We agreed as a society that we're all born equal, that discrimination is a bad thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, scripturally, I believe it was Jesus who said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, unto God what is God. And I think this is, you know, one of those things here. You know, the government has quite rightly passed, you know, legislation against discrimination on any grounds, then we as a church need to abide by those laws, because those are the laws of the land in which we live.
Yeah.
That aside from it being, I think, quite straightforward that you've got to abide by the laws of the land, even from the point of view of the laws of the church, I think the church would be in a very, very, very difficult situation if we applied the letter of that law in the Bible to its entirety today. We have women in church who are the PCCs, who are church wardens, who are priests, who are deacons, who are even flower arrangers. And all these things are ministry, and they're all seen as ministry. And if we're saying that actually Scripture says no to women bishops because of the bits of Scripture which we've looked at tonight, being Timothy and Corinthians, then we lose all of those women too. Or we lose those women, the church falls apart.
Hmm.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
The church fails to work. I can't see how a woman's ministry can be any less than a man's. At all. It's beyond me. To suggest it otherwise is ridiculous.
Yeah. Now, what's come out of this is, although the church is saying, it's now saying, yes, women can be bishops, and we're all thinking, great, we're moving forward. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're already breaking the law because anti-discrimination laws came in a long time ago. So, you know, why they seem to be allowed to take longer to make... Well, they should be able to make their minds up about it. It should already be...
Well, when the legislation was passed, there was opt-outs for all sorts of different groups, not just the church. And that was actually part of the law at the time when the Discrimination Act was passed. And yes, you know, the church is made behind society in, well, quite a few things, really. I mean, we look historically. Obviously, you've got women and the suffragettes, you know, the church spoke out against them. I'll go back further, and it took a long time for the church to speak out against slavery. It is, the church, unfortunately, has a history of being bound by tradition, which I feel doesn't always live up to those laws then, or directives, which Jesus gave us, which I mentioned earlier, which is love God and love your neighbour. I don't see how any form of discrimination can be classed as love your neighbour.
Sure.
And if we don't love our neighbour, then we're not loving God.
So, do you think, is it time to disestablish the church?
It's a difficult question.
Because I think if a church is going
to disestablish, I think the difficulty is we are living in a far more secular society than we've ever lived in before. I think, you know, more and more church is seen as an irrelevance in society, which I disagree with. I think the church is a massive part to play in society, and a very vital and important part at that. I also look at the fact that a lot of the buildings which are used by church, the churches themselves, would be far beyond the means of this disestablished church to maintain. And some of these buildings are Grade 1 listed buildings. You know, they play an important part of this country's history. And if we were to let them to rack and ruin, it would be an absolute travesty. And I think if we disestablish the church as it is at the moment, then we run the risk of losing these buildings and losing that history, which I think would be a travesty. Although, as I say, I can see your point. That as a secular society, many people will be questioning why taxpayers' money is put towards
bigotry, in one word, and, you know, misogyny or whatever you want to call it, discrimination.
Yeah,
because,
absolutely.
I mean, we're talking about women because that's been the story. But, you know, you've got gay bishops.
As this whole story is rumbling on at the moment, you've got the question of Geoffrey John, who I believe is the current dean of Southwark, who. Again, I mean, it was a couple of years ago he was going to be asked to be a bishop, and once again the question has reared its head again as to whether he could perform the role as a bishop again. Now, for me, this is a difficult one because I have no issue with gay clergy whatsoever, whether they be bishops, priests, or deacons. What I do think the church has to take concern of, though, is the wider church, and at the moment there is a moratorium on ordaining gay clergy as bishops, and I think that the Church of England has to abide by that in this particular case, and maybe that is the wrong thing to do, because Canon John is actually a fantastic candidate.
I agree, he's one of the most insightful...
Absolutely, he's an incredibly intelligent man, very faithful, and I would have no problem with him...
Being the next Archbishop of Canterbury?
Potentially, if that's the way it went, then yeah, I'd have no problem with that at all. However, I think we have to... The Anglican Communion, I mean, the Church of England is part of the Anglican Communion, which is a worldwide body, and I think we have to take into account the concerns of our brothers and sisters around the world, whether they're right or wrong, they have their views, and that has to be respected. And one of those things was that we took a decision to say that we aren't going to ordain, following Gene Robinson's ordination in America, we aren't going to ordain any more gay clergy because of the problems this is causing the worldwide church. And I think that the Church of England has to abide by those rules at this moment in time. I think, unfortunately for Canon John, it's too early for the church to ordain an openly gay man as a bishop at this moment in time. And that is wrong. But I think for the church itself, and for the church to survive, I think they need to really think very carefully and, you know, start educating people around the world as to why there's absolutely no problem with a gay man being elected a bishop. But I think at the moment we have to respect our brothers and sisters around the world, and unfortunately that means that I have to say I don't think we should be ordaining Canon John at this moment as a bishop.
Hmm. I mean, I have to kind of disagree.
I'm sure you would. I fully expected you to.
I disagree because, I mean, you said a couple of things there, right, which I find they're just like glaring inconsistencies, which just, you know, it's coming back to dogma, and I don't like to see it because it's a very ugly face. For instance, now, okay, you're saying we have to respect other people's opinions. Well, I don't necessarily know if that's completely true, because if you know, okay, something's wrong, okay, you know, I'm not into this relative morality where, oh, well, what's true to you, what's true to you, because that's crap. At the end of the day, there's right stuff and there's wrong stuff, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we could talk about the philosophy of absolute morality all night, okay? But I think we'll save that for a special or something. But what I mean is, right, okay, is, and it's just going back to the established bit, okay? Because as an established church, I think, okay, that if you, I'm not even saying I'm ruling out, you know, I'm a big fan of secular society. I'm not necessarily completely in favour of, you know, getting rid of the church tomorrow, disestablishing the church tomorrow. Because as you said, it does provide purpose, especially in British society, even if you just call it hatches, matches and spatches.
Sure.
Yeah? And as you're talking about, you've got a lot of architecture. There's a lot. It's been around for so long, you know. I'm not saying that's a reason to keep it, but if you're going to be the established church, I'm afraid society should be dictating to you how you behave, and not these in this infighting
mm-hmm.
between the liberals and the conservatives. Okay, it's kind of irrelative. Because we already decided as a society to enact laws to say that this is wrong, do not discriminate. And I think it's an untenable position for an established church to break the law.
Okay. Yeah, I'm saying is,
if they follow the rules, because society is what we all are, okay?
Yeah. No, I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying. And in my heart, in my head, I absolutely agree with you. In my heart, I think that the Anglican Communion, which is the worldwide Anglican Church, is something which needs preserving. Because I think throughout the world, the Anglican Communion is a constant which helps so many people in so many different ways throughout the world. And I think, you know, if we lose some of our churches in Africa and other such places, then not only are we missing out on what they bring to us through the terms of their faith and their worship and how they behave, but they'll be missing out in through the support and the brotherhood which they will receive from the Anglican Communion as it stands at the moment. And that's my concern. And if we go out and we elect Canon John now as a bishop tomorrow, and those churches then schism from the communion and go their separate ways, I think there could be serious consequences for the normal person, you know, living in Africa who can't rely on the support of the communion. That would be my worry. And that's why I don't think we're currently in a position, sadly, to ordain or elect a gay bishop. And I personally see no real reason for it other than this. And maybe that's wrong. It's just the way I feel, I'm afraid.
But I just think, you know, it's like having a cake and eating it. you know, being the established church, but not actually being, behaving like an established church.
Well, you know, as I've said, I do kind of agree with you, but I mean, they do have the right to opt out, and that is part of the law.
Ah, but, well, and yeah, you're right.
So, I mean, you know, to say they need to abide by the law, well, on a technicality, they are.
Yeah. I just got a feeling, you know, that in the very near future, the law will change.
And if the law does change, then I guess the church has to change with it as well. But as it stands at the moment, they are acting within... My personal opinion is going back to the original story. But yes, absolutely, women bishops should be allowed. I see absolutely no reason why we should forsake their ministry. I personally see no reason why a gay man shouldn't be appointed a bishop. I'm just thinking of the wider Anglican communion.
Yeah. I just think the way it is, it looks like people, even if you just took it out of the law, forget the law for a second and just look at what's the moral thing to do. You know, they're just choosing to preserve themselves over what is morally right. Mm. So, I mean, that's a little bit of it. And the only thing I want to touch on with the women bishops is, although they've decided to allow them, they've gone and created an opt-out for any parishes.
No, I thought the opt-out had been rejected. I thought that was the point. The archbishops tried to put an opt-out in place whereby local churches did not have to abide by the episcopal authority of a woman bishop and could have a flying bishop, as it were, who'd work in partnership in the diocese with the woman bishop. However, that was rejected, I believe, by the synod.
Yeah,
which
which
is absolutely correct, because I mean, if I look at the church in Wales, where yes, we still don't ordain women bishops, but we do ordain women to the priesthood, and for many years now, we've also continued to provide episcopal oversight and to continue to ordain men who were against the ordination of women. Now, as far as I'm concerned, when the law was originally passed within the church to allow the ordination of women, it was absolutely the right thing to do to set up episcopal oversight for those priests who'd been ordained prior to that point, who in conscience couldn't accept the ordination of women. Absolutely the right thing to do, because, you know, the church those people joined was different. And I think that was absolutely the right thing to do at the time. However, it was wrong, I believe, for the church to continue to ordain men who are anti the ordination of women, and to still continue to do that, because actually now the church has moved on, it has accepted the ordination of women, and when you get ordained, you agree to abide by the laws of the church in Wales, and you agree to be held under the authority of your bishop. And for me, anyone who's making their vows saying they'll agree to do this but doesn't accept the ordination of women is clearly not genuine in making those vows.
Okay, I mean, it just, yeah, you're right, I just double-checked that, and you're right, they didn't pass it through. But when I originally saw this story, you know, that's what they were trying to achieve.
It was what they were trying to achieve.
It was just discrimination through the back door.
Yeah, absolutely. But they were trying to make life easier for those people who couldn't accept it. But I think we've gone past that now. As I said earlier on, once we said that, yes, we can accept women to the priesthood, there's absolutely nothing to stop further advancement to the episcopate. It doesn't make any sense. There's no grounding for it.
No. Just a little tidbit, I noticed. Over 500 clergy have left the Church of England since the 1990s, when the synod agreed to allow women into the priesthood, receiving payouts totalling £27.4 million. Some of them later returned to the fold.
Wow. Well, I'd like to think that, you know, maybe the Holy Spirit has worked upon those men, and they have seen the error of their ways, and that, you know, there is nothing wrong with the ministry of women.
Cool. Right, we've battered that one. Sterilise the poor or bring back the workhouse. Public's bizarre suggestions for spending cuts. Now, to be fair to the Mail, they're not actually suggesting this, they're just reporting on it in this case.
But I think it's indicative of the Mail's readership that maybe the quality of the reporting in other areas where you can actually see where these people are coming from.
Right, here we go. Now, first of all, they have to stick the knife in, okay, because this is yet another brainchild of the new Open Coalition. Obviously, the Mail doesn't like the Coalition, because there's a liberal element to the Coalition.
It's a little bit too yellow, isn't it?
Yes, yes, they don't like it. Basically, this website was set up, okay, by the government. I'm kind of cringing already, knowing that they've, you know, the Coalition swept in and said, right, we're going to cut spending, and they've been shutting down all these websites that the last government started up. But now they're opening another website. You know, it's like business as usual sometimes. Asking the public, how can the government save money? Okay, maybe this might be worthwhile. But, of course, the Daily Mail readers had to go and jump all over it.
Absolutely. I'd expect no less.
Yes. Once again, the idea has fallen victim to a string of outlandish suggestions. Just like the scheme asking which laws should be scrapped. Right, okay, only last week there was another website the government set up, I don't know if you saw this, right? Asking people what laws should be repealed, because they've already repealed, or they're planning on repealing, things like the identity cards and things like that.
Absolutely.
They're basically saying the last government enacted all these laws, too much red tape, let's get rid of them.
Yeah, okay.
And I remember, yeah, and I was like, cool. And some of them were serious, some of them were like, let's cut back on some of these libel laws, because... they're really cutting down on free speech at the moment. Just the obvious ones, you know, libel laws, things like that. But then some people decided to take it a bit too far. Instead of talking about laws which should be repealed, they wanted some laws bringing back, okay?
Right, okay.
Yeah, so here we go. Here come the Conservatives. These are some of the laws that we want to come back. What was number one?
Let me guess, capital punishment.
Correct. Yes, we should bring back hanging because, you know... if we kill more people, there'll be less people around.
It's a deterrent. It's a deterrent.
Yeah, brilliant. Idiots. Okay, so that happened last week. Now this week, you got this spending challenge website. Okay, it's been bombarded with possibilities for savings, but some are offensive and others simply bizarre. I prefer bizarre to offensive. Okay, one of them, one suggestion writer suggested, teacups over 150 mL should be banned. Okay, this is for public servants, okay?
Okay.
And fluid monitors brought in to impose fines for transgressions, claiming it could save £11 billion a year. So all they're saying is they're going to cut down the amount of tea they're drinking, so you're going to save some money on that. But obviously, because they don't go to the loo as often, you're not losing money.
Efficiency cuts, absolutely. Yeah, brilliant.
So it's, I mean, it's completely bizarre.
That takes some kind of special genius to come up with that.
Especially to come up with a figure of 11 billion a year.
What amazes me, though, is that you know, you're cutting the amount of tea a person can drink during the day, but you're employing someone to check it.
Yeah.
A tea monitor. Brilliant.
Yeah, that just sounds like the last government.
How much do you pay a tea monitor?
Well, I don't know, it's not going to be 11.
Well, it's got to be national minimum wage, isn't it? So, you know.
I mean, whoever came up with this, if that 11 billion a year is a realistic figure, I know it's bizarre.
And what happens if your tea monitor goes on break? What do you do then if you want
to
tea?
Everyone's going to go grabbing the Big Mugs up. Yowing him back. Yeah, no, he's not watching.
I've 8 cups of tea.
To get the espresso, you know, I'm good. You know, you've seen these Starbucks coffees.
Give me the venti.
Yeah, it's just going to be ridiculous. Right, here we go. Other suggestions include forcing the poor to be sterilised, calling for a return of the workhouse, and forcing benefits claimants to work in sweatshops. So it's basically saying poor people can't afford kids, so they should be sterilised. On paper, all these ideas make sense to Hitler and you know, various other people that had ideas for making the world a better place.
I think it's a great idea. You know, we've all seen the... you know, the dangers of allowing the chav class to rise, you know. We've seen Idiocracy, John, you know, it's...
yeah, I know.
It's,
yeah.
It's a terrible future state to see.
And I used to say so naive, like, you know, well, you know, if you get rid of all the working class people, who's going to actually do the work? But, yeah, you know, a lot of people would just say, well, they don't even
know.
Oh, work.
So naive, John, yeah, so naive.
Well, you know, I can't believe this. Calling for a return of the workhouse... You know, I mean, it's kind
so who's of my first question? Sorry, I mean, the workhouse. We'll come back to that. But who's going to pay for all these poor people to be sterilised?
Yeah, I don't think it's a cheap procedure, is it? Yeah.
You know, do we just sterilise them? You know, sterilise the men. Or do we sterilise the women, or do we sterilise both, just to be sure?
All right, okay, okay. Right. Before we carry on, right, let's just explore. Right. So, let's look at the implications of this. What we're saying is, okay, we're saying, right, these people are poor, okay, so therefore they can't afford children, so therefore they shouldn't have them. Okay, that's the logic I'm guessing here.
I guess so, yeah.
So, you know, I think any... Surely if you were the person organising this as, you know, director, or sorry, dictator, you know, you'd probably just do the men. You know, you'd leave the women for yourself or something. You
but
know,
so but when do you decide to sterilise men? Do you do it? I mean, when do you do it? I mean, let's face it, these young rapscallions are getting onto the scene now, onto the action, from quite a young age.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we've got this population explosion. Oh, no, sorry, that's the immigrant.
That's the immigrant, yeah. So, you know, where do you say that now is the right time to cut those tubes, cut those pipes, you know, is it...
Well, I don't know if that, I think sterilising, surely they're thinking of something reversible, because if you're poor, and then so you make millions of pounds...
Well, what if you win the lottery?
Yeah, you're not poor anymore, so what, do they reverse it? There's complications there, you know. And also, what happens the first day... You go to sterilise someone, and it is an invasive procedure, and they die. I'm thinking if you've got so far to actually get through legislation to sterilise people, you don't worry about people claiming. It's just so ridiculous. I can't even pretend to explore it as an idea.
Seriously, you just can't do it. It is insane.
Yeah.
It's absolute insanity.
Okay, so the workhouse.
The workhouse, you've still got to pay someone the national minimum wage. You know, you can't pay someone a pittance, or pay someone in vouchers, or pay someone in accommodation, because that's illegal. You know, you have to pay someone a national minimum wage. So, what is a workhouse going to cost?
But surely, if you're going to bring workhouses back, are you going to repeal legislation?
Absolutely. But if you're going to bring workhouses back, what work are these people going to do? We don't have any heavy industry really in this country anymore. We don't have the old style cotton mills.
But this is the thing. You could have it again. Because these people are working for pittance, all of a sudden it would become profitable. The reason it's not profitable at the moment is because of...
So let's wind the clock back to 1850, yeah.
Well, that's what...
Because obviously life was so much better then.
Hey,
cholera and diphtheria being rife.
I know this, you know this.
I know. These people are just idiots. That, you know.
Forcing benefits claims into sweatshops and all this. You know, I mean, it's kind of already happening because...
Let's take it to the next level. Let's force these benefits claimants into sweatshops in Taiwan.
So then you're deporting them as well. So you're kind of reducing... You know, why don't you just deport them?
There we go. So you get rid of them.
Like have an island somewhere where you can just put them on there.
Maybe somewhere in the South Pacific. Quite a large landmass, say.
Something where hardly anyone lives. Most of it's not even used or anything.
No.
If only that place existed. one sensible one. Stop spending money on illegal wars and false accusations to justify stealing other countries' resources. So
that sounds perfectly reasonable to me.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that's the... no, it's not from the Daily Mail, is it? Because I was going to say, if that was written on the Daily Mail website, I'm guessing that'd be somebody hijacking it. But this has come from the government website, hasn't it?
That comment. Yeah. No, as I said, it was this website that the government... Yeah. So it sounds so good. Okay. Yes, that's that story. That's dead. I mean, I just thought it was funny that, you know... I mean, it's going back to the last election. You know, there were people seriously considering voting far-right parties like BNP and UKIP just because there's massive fear of foreign people.
Absolutely. I was quite glad to see that the BNP actually lost ground this time, I believe, which did kind of restore some of my faith in the people of this country because, you know, the fact that we've actually had BNP run councils terrifies me, to be honest with you. I can't understand the mentality of people voting for these fascist idiots.
And I said this before, if people are genuinely concerned about overpopulation, okay, because you say to somebody, well, why do you want to deport all these people? You know, the country's getting overrun, there's not enough space, so many resources. Well, you know, technically they may be right. You know, I mean, we do have finite resources, and so therefore, you know, if the population increases, that means everybody's share is going to get smaller, or you know, eventually it's going to run out.
Sure.
All this. But if they are honestly serious about, you know, doing, you know, reducing the population, I don't hear these same people talking about saying, well, maybe we should be limiting the number of children people have, or things like that. Because that would
Well, they're talking about sterilising poor people, John.
Well,
these are the same people.
Yeah, no, sure, but sterilising poor people is a bit different from, you know, say, I think the Chinese method of legislating against numbers of children is, you know, it's just as bad as sterilisation, perhaps. But, you know, tax breaks for people that have one child. And things like that, maybe that might be worthwhile. If you're serious, you should be considering things like this. Not just saying, oh, let's deport anybody who's not the same colour skin as me.
You know, I don't believe we have an overcrowding problem in this country. We may have an overcrowding problem in some cities and in some boroughs of cities.
Yeah, sure.
But you come out to the cities and actually you know, there's quite a lot of space still in this country. And I have no issue with immigration per se, but I would be inclined to say that maybe we do need to toughen up our immigration admissions process. You know,
well, I mean, first of all, why? I mean, what is it that's going on at the moment that you think is, you know...
Well, you know, I just think that in the current climate with so few jobs, I don't think it is right to be bringing over unskilled labour. So, for instance, say I wanted to personally emigrate to New Zealand or to Australia, I would have to be taking a skill of value to that country.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely what we should be looking to do here. Because I have no problem with somebody coming to this country, you know, doctors, nurses, whatever.
We need them. Well, do we,
absolutely. I've got no issue with that whatsoever. You know, they do a great job. Absolutely fantastic. And I have no problem whatsoever with that. But, you know, we don't need any more people coming in just doing general business. Just doing general jobs. You know, that's not the type of skills that we need. We need particular skills in particular areas, and I think we should be targeting those for immigration.
But with our membership in the EU, I mean, people...
But then, that's a separate issue, because I was going to come on to that. That's people from outside the EU. With our membership of the EU, then we have to allow people to come in here. That's part of our agreement.
Part of our commitment, yeah.
I mean, you know, if I wanted to go and work in Germany tomorrow, I could.
Yeah.
If I wanted to go and work in Czech Republic, I could. You know, there's nothing to stop me doing that. And likewise, there's nothing to stop those people from those countries coming over here to work. And I've got no issue with that either, John. You know, I think the migration works both ways within Europe. And that's absolutely fair enough. And, you know, the other factor is this. Eastern Europeans come to our country, and quite often they end up doing the really crap jobs, which nobody in this country wants to do.
And it's always been that way. It's been that way since the 50s.
Absolutely. So, you know, fair play to them, is what I say, and welcome to Britain.
You know, I mean, I hear a lot of people saying, oh, we don't want these asylum seekers, and this is another issue yet again.
Genuine asylum seekers should always be welcome into this country.
I mean, people don't seem to understand that, you know, if they're genuine asylum seekers, means if you send them back, they're going to end up being killed, stoned to death, or whatever they've done.
Absolutely. I mean, it was ridiculous, wasn't it, recently? You know, we were talking about deporting gays back to their own countries, where they would be stoned to death,
yeah,
provided they lived their life in secret.
Well, that was the reason. Oh, we're sending them back. It's up to them whether they tell the authorities whether they're gay or not. Are you serious?
Absolutely. Saying that, that's just a death sentence to those people. And we need to be more responsible. If we have somebody approaching our shores with a genuine claim for asylum, they should be sheltered.
And I think once you put that case to everybody, the humanity case, they agree. Mm. But on the other hand, you know, as soon as it comes to you know, problems with the economy, they'll switch, they'll change their mind like that, and they'll be, you know, blaming all the immigrants again. And I just don't. First of all, I think the problem's overblown.
Yeah, agreed. It's another media-driven...
Yeah. I mean, I know people who are, you know, not necessarily right-wing, but what I would call conservative voters, but they're business people. And they're the ones that are telling me, you can't stop immigration, we need them. You know,
yeah,
these people are coming here and doing the jobs, they work hard.
Absolutely, and I mean, that is something which at the risk of sounding like a Daily Mail reader myself here, these are jobs which people quite often in this country are too lazy and bone idle to do because they feel that it is somewhat beneath them.
They feel that, that they deserve to be, more.
Than... Absolutely. I blame part of that on programs such as The X Factor and that, which I think give people false dreams. We seem to have lost the work hard ethic, I think, in this country, and people quite often expect things to be given to them rather than having to work for them. And in my experience, we've got our, I guess, colleagues coming over from Eastern European countries who are happy to do the jobs which people in our country just won't do. I mean, you go to any hotel in the country and you'll find that most of the cleaning staff are foreign. You know, our hospitality industry would fall apart if we sent all the immigrants back.
Yeah, and it just makes me laugh because people think that, you know, because they're all saying, oh, they're here nicking our jobs. No, they're here because we need them. Yeah, immigration just screwed up the entire election, really, because instead of, you know, I was looking for a party that was going to take the country forward, get us out of the mess, and everybody seemed to want to find that they just vote for and the one that's going to boot out the most foreigners or something like that.
On the subject of the election, what I wanted from the main parties or for any of the parties was to actually give me some policies, which was missing quite dramatically from, Labour and the Conservative manifestos.
Yeah, I mean, I know the Liberals have policies, but a lot of people just laughed at them because they thought they were, because the right-wing press painted them as completely unattainable, unbelievable. All right, let's wrap it up. This is us. How long have we taken? How long have we been doing this?
Well, it's now 1 hour, 29 minutes, and 9 seconds.
So, okay, so by the time we edit all the crap, we've probably got a good
10 minutes.
great. Okay, so, right, now the idea is, hopefully we'll get some feedback, it's going to be nice, and we'll come back and we'll do another one.
Yeah, I'd like to say thanks for people listening to us rambling.
I'm hoping that, you know, we'll play it back to ourselves, and then we'll discover that we actually sound highly intelligent and that, you know, people are just bound to want to listen to us.
Well, that's always the case, but I want to thank people for listening to us.
And if anybody has any comments, I'll put an address up and people can come and leave some comments or something.
Absolutely. Please don't sue us, though.
No. No one's going to sue us. We disclaimed everything. We made a disclaimer. We said, look, allegedly, we use the word allegedly all the time, okay? That means
we're safe.
That means we have made no attempt to speak any facts whatsoever. There's no facts. It's fact-free. There's no facts involved. So, yeah, thanks a lot, and see you next week, hopefully. Just think what
true.